Hey, well, it's a great pleasure to be back here in Santa Barbara after a long absence, actually. It's not been since the 1980s that I've been here for physics, at least. So the story I want to tell you today is about the counterterms and about the ping pong match that we've been having with V over the past, how many now? 14 years, 13 years.
That's too long.
They're too many years. But this turns out to have been, although Paul Howe and I have lost two bottles of wine in the process, it's turned out to have been quite fruitful. I hope on both sides in terms of stimulating questions and focusing attention on what needs to be looked at next. So continuing a tradition that's been established in this workshop, I put a slide up here with far too many references to read. I'll repeat some of these, but maybe not all of these as we go through. Basically, what I'm going to tell you about comes, the newish material comes from those three papers at the top. So let's just begin with a little bit of, here's sort of the outline of what I want to say. I want to summarize for you some of the traditional discussions of non-renormalization theorems and the notion of the power counting degree of counterterms, and also the BPS degree, the degree to which counterterms are written over the full superspace or only over of subsurfaces of superspace. We've heard a lot about the unitarity-based calculations here in this workshop, but I remind you of the relevant aspects of those results for us. And then I want to go on to some more modern ways of studying counterterms, not directly in superspace itself, which has the funny name of ectoplasm. It's Jim Gates you should blame on that. I'll explain the term as we go along. And then finally, I'll end up with the more powerful ways we've finally, basically, the bottom line is we've understood everything, in supergravity at least, that our unitarity friends have found. And it turns out that one element that we were missing earlier on is really the importance of duality, which is more powerful than we had anticipated. And in fact, we can use some of the unitarity-based calculations in the cases where infinities are known precisely to knock out infinities in the other places of current interest. So let's just begin by reminding ourselves that general relativity and its supergravity extensions are power counting non-renormalizable theories. That is to say that as you go up in loop order, in dimensions above 2, the degree of divergence of a diagram gets worse and worse and worse. So here's the formula for delta is the power counting weight of a given loop order diagram in a given dimensionality, d minus 2 times loop order plus 2. So at the very interesting case of 3 loops in 4 dimensions, one expects power counting weight 8. Now, there's been also a lot of discussion of regularization styles and so forth, and also life in fractional dimensions. But let me just say that in the traditional way of viewing things in dimensional regularization, you collect only the 1 over epsilon poles, where epsilon is d minus 4. This corresponds to the logarithmic divergences in a straight momentum cutoff regularization. Now, in order to see the logarithm, of course, you have to have the same total power counting weight here, and that can be achieved by pushing factors of momentum onto the external line. So you have to push 8 powers of momentum onto the external lines in order to come down to the logarithm. And then that corresponds to 8 powers of momentum. You have to respect all the symmetries of the theory, too. So what possible counterterms can correspond to that? And this was studied long ago in the case of supergravity. The first time you can have a non-vanishing counterterm that doesn't vanish subject to the classical field equations in all supergravity theories happens at the 3-loop order. And it had this interesting structure, quartic in curvatures. So indeed, you can see that there are 8 derivatives in 4 curvatures. That corresponds in momentum space to the power counting weight 8. And it had this interesting structure as the square of the Bell-Robinson tensor. This is the 4-dimensional version of the counterterm. And then there are generalizations of this counterterm in all the higher dimensional cases that we might want to talk about. Of course, that's very intriguing as well, because this should remind string theorists precisely of the alpha prime cubed corrections that occur in the superstring effective action. except, of course, that the string theory is finite. So these corrections occur with finite coefficients in string theory. But one can nonetheless ask the question, can one use string theory as a rather expensive regularization for field theory? That is to say, if we take the 10-dimensional string theory, dimensionally reduce it down to 4 dimensions with appropriate careful rescalings to keep the Newton's constant in the lower dimension of constant value, don't allow it to diverge, then it's possible that you could develop poles in 1 over alpha prime and then take the zero slope limit. This is the way that you can try to use string theory as a regulator for supergravity. And I hope that Pierre is going to talk about precisely the decoupling issues that come up here. I unfortunately won't be able to make your talk, Pierre, but you've written recent work. I think one of the good things about this ping pong discussion with three teams is we now basically all agree on where the candidate infinities come. Except that things were happening this morning, of course.
But your paper to give us.
Yeah, right. So I'm going to leave to Pierre to discuss the string theory approach to this. But that certainly is another conjugate way of viewing this whole story, to try to derive supergravity results from string theory. Okay, well, back to the purely field theoretic approach. In the early days, we simply made the natural requirement, without too much studying reward identities in careful detail, but the natural requirement was that if you have a symmetry, the counterterms ought to respect that symmetry. But actually, there's more power to supersymmetry than that. And actually, we've known that since the very first days of supersymmetry, that there are non-renormalization theorems that tell you also that certain supersymmetric counterterms nonetheless cannot occur in as infinite counterterms. Certain operators that are perfectly supersymmetric, and in fact you might want to include in the starting theory, can be ruled out as counterterms. And the classic example is the set of chiral invariants in just n equals 1 Vesumino models. Functions, I call the W, a superpotential of a chiral field. So I'm using a bit of superspace language here. The d bar is the d by d theta bar derivatives, superspace covariant derivative. If the integrand is a constrained object by the chirality condition, then instead of integrating over the full superspace, which for n equals 1 would be d4 theta integral, then if it's a d4 theta integral, you can integrate your grandmother's old hat as long as it's some function of superfields. But if you have a chiral integrand, then you can integrate over a subsurface, d2 theta. So that's perfectly supersymmetric, but you can prove a non-renormalization theorem that says that these terms do not occur as counterterms, and that is the one reason actually why we're talking about supersymmetry now, because it is the fundamental observation about the supersymmetric extensions of the standard model that controls the infinities and controls the convergence of coupling constants is precisely this non-renormalization theorem. So that's the story of lesser supersymmetries like n equals 1, where we have full control over all of the supersymmetry. That is to say, we can manifestly and linearly realize all the supersymmetries in a formalism. Linear transformations are nice because we can write Ward identities and we can stamp our foot on the floor and say, we know how to control this. Modulo issues of regularization, which are always lurking in the background with supersymmetric discussions, but actually this is really quite firm. But we're in not such a good situation with the maximal theories, maximal supergravity and maximal super Yang-Mills, because for various mischievous reasons, these theories don't have formalisms with all the supersymmetries linearly realized. And what the mathematical structure of this theory is trying to tell us about that, we don't quite know, but it's just a feature. Maybe a feature, not a bug, I don't know. So we don't have what we call off-shell formulations with all 32 supergravity symmetries linearly realized, or super Yang-Mills all 16. But what you can try to do is just do the best you can and look for the maximum amount of linearly realized supersymmetry and work with that and derive the appropriate non-renormalization theorems. So the degree of off-shell supersymmetry, therefore, is the maximum amount that you can you can realize so that the supersymmetry transformations close without use of the equations of motion. Now, there's a long study to figure out what is the maximal amount, and I don't actually want to go into that here today. This is sort of the older way of thinking, of looking for the linear realizations. But let me just note that it may involve formulations with harmonic superspace with infinite numbers of auxiliary fields and so forth. This is still an open debate of what, in fact, the maximal amount is. It happens for super-Young-Mills that we know that instead of the 16 components of super-Young-Mills theory that one would have liked to have had linearly realized, one can realize 8 for sure, and actually one can realize 9 in a non-Lorentz covariant fashion. So we've known since the 1980s that at least half of the full supersymmetry can be linearly realized for the maximal super-Young-Mills and for the maximal supergravity theory. So,
is there a light cone?
Light cone is one of these realizations, right? So there were various ways of cutting the pie in the early days. We first, together with Paul Hall and Paul Townsend, wrote an n=2 formulation of n=4 super Young-Mills, and from that derived a proof of the finiteness. A little bit later, Mandelstam did his light cone formulation, which cuts the pie down the Lorentz group. Again, it's 8 out of the 16 components, and basically, for n=4, everybody agreed. When we go into supergravity and super Young-Mills, then you have more power, more potential divergences. The power counting weight is different in higher dimensions in particular. We go to super Young-Mills to higher dimensions precisely to make it non-renormalizable to compare. Okay, and I want to go on and talk about that precisely because actually I want to outline this as sort of the original way of thinking, and because of these guys and lost bottles of wine and so forth, we've realized this isn't enough. But back in the 1980s, we would call these the half BPS counterterms precisely because there's a constraint on the integrand, which basically rules out dependence on half of the thetas of superspace, and you integrate over the other half, okay? So for these half BPS operators, we expected that these would be the first allowed counterterms back in the 1980s. And in fact, we have some nice structures for them. This is the parallelism between super Young-Mills and supergravity is very striking here. So we have an R to the fourth candidate counterterm in maximal supergravity and an F to the fourth candidate counterterm in maximal super Young-Mills. Both of these are half BPS invariants, so they integrate over half the full superspaces, and here they have a very similar structure. You have phi ij is anti-symmetric in the R symmetry SU4 indices, so it's that Young tableau, it's the 6 of SU4, because it's the 6 scalars of n=4. I've written this in the four-dimensional version of the counterterms. If you go to higher dimensions, there's some rearrangement of which are scalars, which are components of the vector field. And indeed, you can see that this is written in a formulation where the SU4 is manifest. In total, I'm integrating out of over 8 thetas and theta bars here. They have to, with the SU4 indices, have to be arranged into that representation. It's the 105 of SU4. And similarly, the integrand has to be in that representation. And then one can see that this particular combination actually is fully supersymmetric in terms of the full superspace of the theory, but it is a subsurface integral. But then we said, okay, but all we can guarantee is half the total supersymmetry. And then you have to work on this. You have to bash on it quite a lot in order to show that subject to the constraints on the integrand, if you're willing to give up half the supersymmetry and ask only for manifestly n=2 supersymmetry, per se, then you can rewrite this, of course, as 8 thetas is just enough for a full superspace integral of half the supersymmetry. And you can rewrite it that way. So it looked like an okay counterterm. And similarly for supergravity, where you have the 70, this is basically these are with respect to linearized supersymmetry, I should say, because doing the full nonlinear structure becomes a lot of work, and there's quite a discussion about how to go beyond the leading level. But so let's just take the leading level here. The scalars form a 70 of SU8, and basically you arrange it into this sort of checkerboard pattern. And similarly for the integrand and measure, this 16 thetas is half of 32, and you can rewrite it in an n=4 fashion as a full superspace interval. It looked okay. So we thought these were the first allowed counterterms. These are the grown-up generalizations of the Bell-Robinson squared R to the fourth counterterm. And in fact, such counterterms do occur in supergravity theories. They occur in higher dimensions. For example, they occur at one loop, both in super Yang-Mills and in supergravity, in eight dimensions. So they certainly are supersymmetric. One loop, however, is always requires an asterisk and a footnote. There's always a discussion about special properties of one loop, also for you guys. And using the background field method, you have to calculate one loop separately, etc. So whether this really tells you that much about the non-renormalization theorems is not clear, just the fact that it occurs at one loop. So one has to be careful about the general acceptability of these counterterms. We thought they were acceptable. Now, there are other supersymmetries that you have to try to take account of, aside from diffeomorphism, invariance, and supersymmetry. And in particular, n equals 8 supergravity has a rigid, non-linearly realized E7 symmetry. Okay, so one should be careful about that as well. Nonlinear symmetries are a pain in the butt. You have to worry about their Ward identities, but certainly at the leading level, one should expect this to be respected. Now, the nonlinear transformations, of course, it's E7 divided by SU8 is the coset space structure of the scalar fields. That's a 70-dimensional coset, and the nonlinear transformations in the very leading order correspond to just constant shifts of the scalar. So it's a rigid symmetry. So at first order, this is just shift. So if it's that counterterm could have failed by failing to be invariant at this leading order by constant shifts of the 70 scalars. Now what you have to do is you have to take that counterterm. There are 16 theta integrals to do. You have to do all of them down to the last drop. And then you find that all 70 scalars in the leading piece are covered by derivatives. It's possible to, you may have to integrate by parts and so forth, but we'll allow to integrate by parts. The leading four particle order, that integrand looks okay in the sense that it is invariant under constant shifts of the 70 scalars. And so that's all we could tell in the 1980s about the E7 invariance. It looked like it was beginning to play along with E7, but the full nonlinear structure we couldn't say anything about. I'm going to come back to that later on in this talk, but we now understand how to say some more about that issue. So it looked like the art of the fourth counterterm was being acceptable. And then along came the unitarity boys, right? And then they start teaching us how to do calculations in a dramatically different fashion. Again, since...
Why do you expect that E7 to be exact?
It could be renormalized. The transformations can be renormalized. But the first infinity has no possibility of mixing with anything at lower order. Nonlinear transformations can certainly be renormalized. And we expect trouble as soon as you go beyond the first infinity. Then your life may get miserable. Let me make another point, which is Bosar, Hillman, and Nicolai have written a revised formulation of n equals 8 supergravity in which the E7 is manifest. And it's the diffeomorphisms that are not manifest. So you can choose a different formulation where you get the E7 guaranteed by the constitution. Now then you have to worry about diffeomorphism anomalies, but they've checked that they don't occur. So certainly at the leading, there's a lot of difficulty in dealing with nonlinear Ward identities that one has to face in this story. But as soon as you're trying to cut the Apaches off at the pass, and to make sure that you stop the first infinity, right? As soon as you've had your first infinity, then you give up. But if you want to discuss the first infinity, then you don't have to worry so much about the nonlinear Ward identities. That same comment applies to the full supersymmetry, which we're also implicitly using here. Even if we don't have a full off-shell formalism, we have, say, a formalism with half the supersymmetries linearly realized, we nonetheless will require that the full supersymmetry of the counterterm, in the way that we can discuss it, say, putting the external fields on shell and so forth, nonetheless has to be good for the first infinity. Okay. So, here now is what we've learned as a result of a decade or more of calculations. And so we have these, what's written in blue are known divergences here for super Yang-Mills and supergravity. And let's see. Well, okay, as I told you, after the fourth counterterm did occur in super Yang Mills and the art of the fourth in supergravity, but at the one loop level, I've indicated the BPS degree here, which means that's the one quarter BPS operators will need to be integrated over three quarters of the superspace, etc. So, is there anything surprising here? Well, you might have worried about the two loop level. And so I've gone to higher dimensions here precisely to push super Yang Mills into a non-renormalizable context so that we have something to talk about, because in four dimensions it's finite, as we know. One might have thought that at the two-loop level in six dimensions there could have been another F to the fourth counterterm, but actually it turns out that in this case the N equals 4 theory quantized with respect to N equals 2 with minimal supergravity, supersymmetry in six dimensions, splits into a Yang-Mills N equals 2 part and a hypermultiplet N equals 2 part. And actually the hypermultiplet has a bit stronger non-renormalization theorem than the Yang-Mills part, but they all have to fit together, as I just said, Marty. They have to make an overall maximal supersymmetric counterterm. So it's actually the tail that's wagging the dog here that is explaining why the two-loop counterterm does not occur. Yeah.
Because I think maybe this is why it's confusing with your table, is that the reason why at free loop there's only the single, just the counterterm, that the one you wrote, you should have written it's a single trace operator.
Well, I didn't want to get involved in single and double traces.
It's not an F term, it's a D term. You can use in the Konishi operator.
Yes, that's also true. No, this one that does occur is perfectly fine.
It's trace F square square. Is you cannot write it as a full superspace integral, so it's really a quarter BPS space.
Okay, yes, that's true. I was trying to get avoid talking about single and double traces here, but what you say is absolutely correct. The counterterm that's in blue here is perfectly acceptable. It's a full superspace integral, and nobody has any doubts about it. Then there's the double trace part, which there still is discussion about. Yes, but from string theory,
what is confusing when you compare the two tables? I mean, the first table in Yang-Mills, we knew what are true and fake F terms.
Okay.
In the sense of what you can rewrite as a full superspace integral or not full mm-hmm. superspace integral. In the lower part, the gravity part, I mean, this is the problem, is that we don't know who are F terms on true or fake. I mean,
indeed. But this whole discussion about which are F terms or D terms, or in other words, partial superspace integrals or full superspace integrals, I think our current point of view is this is somewhat beside the point. Maybe from string theory with the pure spinner formalism, one can reformulate that, and indeed I hope you will talk about that. But I want to come on, in fact, to another way of viewing all of this. Let me say, however, that in supergravity, first of all, we're going down to the first operator here is happening now at a much lower BPS degree of 1/8, okay? So this basically would have been integrated over 7/8 of the superspace, 28 theta integrals. It certainly looks acceptable, but there's already but less than that. There's a 1/4 operator, 1/4 BPS operator, which already occurred in seven dimensions at two loops. So what's wrong with it? It happened here. Why didn't it happen in six dimensions? That's actually very similar to the point that Pierre was just raising. In supergravity, these guys doing the calculations are throwing up some results here that don't fit very well with this whole story about looking at the BPS degree. Even if we are going to understand what happens with the 1/2 BPS, why those are in fact ruled out when they occur outside one loop. But when it comes down to having the first counterterm being only of 1/8 BPS degree, that's a rather weak constraint on the counterterm. There were previous candidates which didn't occur. So why? So that's the puzzle, and this is where the ping pong match of back and forth and bottles of wine and so forth started, right, with the discussions about this. The parts of these tables in black are merely reflect the current lowest possible orders that a divergence could happen. I'm working in integral dimensions here, so in super Yang-Mills, five dimensions, five loops is an odd order, so by Lorentz invariance you can't have a counterterm there. Some of our friends like to work in fractional dimensions, and okay, so then we can talk about that. But so So that says that in the first candidate dimension for super young Mills here to have an infinity in five dimensions would be first candidate loop would be six loop orders, and similarly down here for supergravity. This doesn't necessarily mean that we believe all of this, but we'll come back to that point. Okay, so can we do better? This whole earlier discussion was based upon trying to identify the part of the supersymmetry that you really can trust, what's linearly realized. There is, of course, the full supersymmetry, which is there, but it's nonlinear transformations. They close subject to the field equations. There's a lot of ugliness there. Can you somehow learn how to use the full Ward identities and get maybe some more drops of juice out of the fruit? Well, there's an approach called algebraic renormalization, which gives a way to approach this. Instead of calculating things like beta functions, basically the message is, you should calculate gamma functions instead. That is to say, even for the original action, so if I'm calling S2 the quadratic action, we use the Kalin-Szymanski equation here for the mu by d mu, where you're looking at the basically the beta functions here, but we consider the insertion of the classical action into its own Ward identities. We make an operator insertion of the classical action into its own Ward identities and watch and see what that operator mixes with. And then the Kalin-Szymanski equation tells us a relationship, first of all, between that set of gamma of anomalous dimensions for an operator insertion and the beta function. So we can learn about the renormalization of the action by looking at these mixing anomalous dimensions. So for example, you might want to mix into S4th, like an F to the fourth operator. There'll be a gamma fourth coefficient from that, and we can determine the renormalization from that anomalous dimension. So this reformulates the renormalization program in terms of the calculus of anomalous dimensions and looks at operator mixings. Now we have to combine this with the power or the consequences of supersymmetry. So one way to say this is, first of all, let's take a commuting scalar parameter and soak up the indices on the supersymmetry generator Q, making thereby a scalar operator. Now, the expression of invariance of a Lagrangian is that Q acting on the Lagrangian it's not an invariant, but it's a total derivative of something. So Q acting on LD should be an exterior derivative, if we write it in form language, of a D-1 form. And then if you apply another Q to this, and you use the supersymmetry algebra, the Q squared, so this will be epsilon gamma epsilon, remember these commuting epsilons, and I'll come back to why they're commuting in a moment, gives a derivative, that's the usual supersymmetry algebra. And then if you combine that with the Poincaré lemma, you can extract a D, and you obtain this result. Of course, using the Poincaré lemma, you have to introduce an unknown exact form, a D of LD minus 2, which in general can be in there in the solution to the Poincaré's lemma. So we get this expression here, that S of Q is basically the BRST operator acting on an LD minus 1. That, of course, can be a D of an LD minus 2. That's the unknown integration term. And then also this insertion term that comes from the supersymmetry algebra, which just inserts epsilon bar gamma epsilon onto one of the indices on LD. So that's what the I here is doing for. So you see, what this supersymmetry is telling you is it's telling you combined stories of three adjacent forms, a D minus 1, and a D minus 2. And you can combine the exterior derivative, the S and the I, into an extended generalized differential that acts on formal form sums. Okay? And in fact, this is nilpotent, this generalized differential. So now we can go through the discussion of Ward identities. We actually have a co-cycle structure with respect to this differential operator. And the Ward identities are going to tell us that the whole co-cycle of the Lagrangian, considered as an operator insertion, has to agree with the co-cycle of its candidate counterterms. So for example, in order for an operator like F to the fourth, what I call S4 here, to mix with a classical action, their co-cycles need to have the same structure. So we need to discuss the structure of cocycles. Doing it this way is a little bit painful. You're basically starting from the high form here and then working down as you keep on applying Poincaré's lemma. And that's a lot of work. So we'd actually like a better way to do that, and it's possible to turn the problem upside down. Now this is what's called ectoplasm. The person guilty of this name, I think, is Jim Gates. But here's the idea. It actually refers to Bryce DeWitt's language about superspace, which has a body and a soul. So the body is the purely bosonic subspace, and the soul is all the theta stuff. And people who watch, of course, in the United States, you have infinite numbers of late-night horror movies. Ectoplasm is out-of-body stuff, right? So we're going to talk about forms in superspace. So we'll have an LD form. And if we can find a closed form in superspace, and then we pull it back to the body and integrate over that, that will be a supersymmetric invariant, providing LD is closed. It might also be completely uninteresting because it integrates out to zero. So if LD is closed because it itself is exact, and then you integrate it, you're going to get zero. So you want closed but non-exact forms, and so arises a cohomology problem. So we need to study the cohomology of closed forms in superspaces. So let's try to update a little bit the previous discussion that I gave and include now the diffeomorphisms together with supersymmetry. The relevant invariance condition now looks like this. If S is the supersymmetry, the BRST operator, S acting on LD plus D0 is the ordinary bosonic exterior derivative acting on LD minus 1. This S squared is, again, is S is nilpotent. It anticommutes with D0. So, in fact, you can go through a similar discussion, which I just did. S acting on LD minus 2 is a D0 acting on LD minus 2, etc. Okay? So this makes that a little bit more swish, the previous discussion. So we have to study a cohomological problem. Now, note that in BRST language, the supersymmetry ghost is a commuting field. Okay, because it's the ghost for an anti-commuting parameter transformation. So what we need to study is the cohomology of the nilpotent operator, which is S plus D0. And the components of the cocycle here are expressions that have D minus Q bosonic indices and Q fermionic indices that correspond to the ghost number Q, corresponding to the number of supersymmetry ghosts. Now, the supersymmetry ghosts are commuting. So these guys that we need to study have D minus Q anti-commuting indices and Q commuting indices. And so the spinner indices are totally symmetric here. And the sum of all forms of this sort, D comma 0, D minus 1 comma 1, etc., spans out a total form in superspace, which can be closed in superspace. And that's the kind of object that we need to study. So we have an isomorphism between the cohomology of closed forms in superspace and the construction of BRST invariant counterterms. So this is really just developing a language for studying the counterterms again, but it gives somewhat different results, especially when you combine it with other features such as duality. So now, just to formalize this a little bit better, the work of Bonoro, Pasti, and Tonin tells us about, for example, flat superspace. This actually should be pretty familiar. The standard one forms have in the fermionic directions is just d theta. In the bosonic directions is dx minus d theta gamma theta because of the torsion in superspace. Dual to these are the covariant derivatives, just an ordinary bosonic derivative d by dx a and d by d theta alpha in the conjugate to that. There's a bigrading of forms into even and odd parts, p comma q, adding up to the total rank n of the form. And as a result, the exterior derivative actually splits into three parts with these three bigradings. There's a bosonic part, a fermionic part, and then this part is due to the torsion in superspace. So the total exterior derivative, pulled back into the tangent space indices, has this structure. So this bosonic derivative part, the ordinary d of ordinary differential geometry, a d by d theta part and a torsion part. What is the torsion part doing here? So d1 is what I call the fermionic derivative, d0 is the bosonic derivative. The torsion part has the following thing. This is really like the insertion I that I talked about in two slides ago. If you have a form omega, and it has p bosonic indices and q fermionic indices, what the torsion part does is torsion, of course, is a gamma matrix. It basically uses the gamma matrix and it contracts the bosonic index on the gamma matrix with one of the bosonic indices on the form, thereby removing one. That's why minus one. And then, of course, the gamma matrices have two symmetrized, when they're lowered, fermionic indices, which then symmetrize all together with the pre-existing symmetrized indices on the form that we're acting on. So this has grading minus 1, comma 2. So we have to keep track of this torsion stuff as we go through. And okay, so then some nice little formulas. When you have the total nilpotence of the exterior derivative splits up into the following set of relations. And now let's study the closure condition. So we need to find a closed form in superspace. We're going to take, remember, the net result of finding this closed form is we're going to pull it back, just extract the purely bosonic indices. It would be a D form. We can integrate that over a D-dimensional space, and we will have a supersymmetric invariant. These are going to be our counter terms. But we do this by studying the total form in superspace, including all the other part, the sort of ectoplasmic part, the out-of-body part containing the sole components with fermionic indices. Now, this is going to have a bunch of LD minus Q comma Q forms going down of various sorts until it gets to a lowest part. Actually, you can look at the dimensions of these things, and you see that as you have more fermionic indices, this part, this component of the superform gets lower and lower in dimensionality. And that's interesting. Now, if you get to the bottom, the lowest one, by virtue of the fact that it is the lowest dimension object, it must be annihilated by the torsion, because the torsion adds two fermionic indices. It would go lower if it weren't zero. So it must be already annihilated by the torsion. So in fact, we can just study the little cohomology of T, the torsion, all by itself. And then from that, we can build the full solution to the closure in superspace. So we first study the cohomology groups of the torsion alone. And then we define a spinorial exterior derivative, which is just act with d1, the d by d theta, but consider the results up to torsion bits. So that's what this means. This is called the spinorial exterior derivative. It's just basically the d by d theta fermionic derivative, but modulo torsion parts. So that's the way that one can now do the calculation and give the way to reformulate BRST cohomology by starting with the lowest dimension component or generator and then working up. So instead of starting at the top and using Poincaré's lemma to grind your way down, you can start at the bottom and apply these operators to move up, and it's more pleasant. So you can solve for all the higher components of the form in terms of the lower components, starting from the generator, which is the lowest non-zero component of the superform. Now, of course, one way that you could have a generator is simply if you go from an LD comma zero with all bosonic and no fermionic indices, LD minus one comma one, D minus two comma two, tuck, 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 all the way down to something with all fermionic indices. That could happen, in which case the lowest component is trivially annihilated by the torsion part, and then you have a complete long list of all possible gradings. That's something that can happen. In fact, it does in important cases. Or it could also stop partway through the series, where you reach a generator, which is the lowest non-zero component of the cocycle, and then it stops. There's nothing below. So that actually is something that happens in an interesting way. For example, if you go to 10 dimensions and look at things like the, let's consider 10 dimensions as an example. So where do we find things that satisfy this torsion cohomology? Well, we have the key identities that guarantee the existence of N equals or maximal super Yang-Mills theory. The kappa symmetries of strings and five brains are also related to this. So gamma 1, 2 is the usual gamma matrix, and applying the rules for torsion, that is to contract another gamma on it on the bosonic index and totally symmetrize the fermionic indices, so there'll be four of them here, you get totally identically zero. And then similarly, gamma 5, 2, again if you apply a gamma 1 to it, contract the bosonic indices, symmetrize the fermionic indices, you get zero. So we have two T cohomology relations here that we can work with. And in fact, you can then have a generator that looks like this, where instead of going from 10 comma 0 down to 0 comma 10, you can have situations where you stop at 5 comma 5 as the lowest dimension operator. And in fact, they can be T-closed by the fact that they contain a gamma 5, 2 factor here. And the rest, in order to make 5 comma 5, this of course is really a wedge in superspace, has to be 5 comma 2 needs a 0 comma 3 in order to complete it to 5 comma 5, which then has to be invariant under the spinorial derivative, the ds. The simplest example of this sort of thing, in fact, is the most trivial type of superinvariant that you can make. This reformulation looks a bit funny when you first look at it, but a full superspace integral in 10 dimensions for n equals 1 has 16 thetas. There's 16 components of the supersymmetry. So how does that get reformulated here? Well, the quantity m here, in fact, turns out to be an 11. You basically want to look for something with 5 open fermionic indices, so you have to take 5 of these 16 thetas away out of the integrand. Remember, we're going to reformulate everything in terms of just x derivatives. So instead of integrating d10x d16 theta, we're going to integrate d10x only of a certain quantity, which of course, in superspace, you can always replace integrations by differentiation. So you can always push the derivatives from the measure onto the integrand. But instead of having all 16 integrals there, we're going to have 11. That opens up 5 indices, which we like. And then here, in fact, we have the m alpha beta gamma is given by this expression. It's a bunch of gamma matrix constructions acting on D11s, and that's where we get the m 0, 3. This is the generator component of the cocycle corresponding to a full superspace integral. It stops halfway down the line. The least constrained superfield has a short cocycle. Okay, this kind of an inversion of phenomena here. And that, however, would be fully acceptable. This is a full superspace integral from the superspace language. It's fully acceptable as a counterterm if we have such a thing, indeed like the full superspace integral of Kanishi. And in fact, it agrees with the structure of the Lagrangian. The Lagrangian also has this same structure. It stops at its cocycle stops at a generator 5, 5. So this is a reformulation of a completely obvious statement that if you have a counterterm that's written as a full superspace integral, it is acceptable as a counterterm. Nobody should be surprised by that, but it's good to see old results in a new language. So, can we use this to prove more interesting statements? Well, yes. So you can derive non-renormalization theorems for various counterterms. And in fact, now to come back to another old friend, f to the fourth, you can in fact see that the f to the fourth counterterm has a different cocycle structure than the Lagrangian. It in fact goes all the way to 0, comma d. It is a more constrained integrand. It has a longer cocycle. And similarly, in supergravity, one can basically learn that the art of the fourth counterterm is ruled out for the same reasons. Here, the study is complicated by local supersymmetry and the fact that the density character of counterterms needs to be taken into account. But actually, that turns out that it helps us when we combine it with duality. So this is basically what I've said here. The trace f to the fourth or trace f squared squared counterterms here, in fact, go all the way to 0, comma d. So that's different from the structure of the Lagrangian's cocycle, and therefore they are illegal. Even though in the 1980s we thought they were the first allowed, they are disallowed. So this way of reformulating the analysis of counterterms actually does give us some benefits. Okay, so can we do more than that? Well, the remainder of the story now involves the injection of duality again. I remind you what I told you about the art of the fourth counterterm back in the 1980s. That we saw that this, at the leading order, the 70 scalars were covered by derivatives, and so we thought that counterterm was okay. We've actually just learned that we could exclude the counterterm for a supersymmetry reason, but now let's look at it from the point of view of duality, which is also interesting. Now we talk about yet another nonlinear symmetry. There are all the worries about how to guarantee its preservation on counterterms, but we are helped here by the recent work of Bossart, Hellman, and Nicolai, who say that you can trade one problem for another. Namely, if you want to, you can make a manifestly E7 covariant formalism here, but it's not manifestly Lorentz covariant, not manifestly diffeomorphism covariant, but trade one problem for another. But at least you can quantize in such a fashion that the E7 is manifest. And moreover, the anomalies for E7 really relate to the anomalies for the linearly realized SU8 subgroup, which was already studied by Neil Marcus back in 1985 and found that they cancel. So there is a worry about anomalies here, but in fact, it's okay. So we take it that we can trust the E7, continuous E7 invariants. One should emphasize that to the string theorists around here. We're not talking about the discretized E7Z symmetry, E7Z, I'm in the United States again, symmetry. We're talking about E7R, right? So these are the continuous transformations of Kramer and Julia. Now, we require the counterterms to be invariant under them. So if we combine this with the cohomological discussion I've just been going through, we get further restrictions on counterterms, and actually what was a disadvantage turns out to be an advantage. The density character of local supersymmetry actually gives us a boost here, because basically, as I've said, in all these superspace discussions, all you really can do is to study the leading order piece of an invariant, because it's just too hard, it gets too messy. But we get an additional little, you know, Jimmy with a Swiss Army knife by this cohomological discussion. I remind you of what we have to do. We have to pull back the counter-Lagrangian form here to the body in a coordinate basis, because of course you have to, now in local diffeomorphism invariant constructions, you have to remember you're supposed to be doing this in a coordinate basis in order to integrate the form, deform, over the volume. Now, in order to pull it back to a coordinate basis, there are a bunch of binds here, field binds here, in superspace, which have to pull it back to the body. But of course, these world indices are the ones that you're integrating over. So I've written it in the way, you know, one would see in Weinberg's book, for example, just as with an epsilon tensor here to show the density character explicitly. But then, of course, these A indices are general superspace indices. They're contracting into all of the forms, all of the components of the superform, not only the purely bosonic part, but also the fermionic parts there as well, providing that the field binds are non-zero in an appropriate background. Well, in fact, here's what I've worked it out. Remember that the components, the leading components of these field binds are, in fact, the straight ordinary gravitational field binds and the gravitini. So the first term here, in fact, just becomes the ordinary density, square root of E. That, of course, you should have expected. I've written this in four dimensions just in order to fit it on the page. In higher dimensions, you have to go on until you write out a deform. And then there are the other possibilities, where some bosonic, some fermionic indices in the various combinations, going all the way to all fermionic indices. So actually, the out-of-body stuff, the soul parts of the form, actually are useful for something, not just proving a complicated way to write an invariance condition, but actually they're showing up in the overall supergravity invariant as covariantizations. And remember that as you go into more and more soul here, the dimension goes lower and lower. So if here we've gone all the way from purely bosonic indices to purely fermionic indices, every time you change, you exchange it for half a unit of dimension. So you've actually got quite a boost here. 2 units of dimension less. Aha. And also remember that the gravitinos do not transform under E7. They transform under the SU8 automorphism symmetry, but not under the E7. None of the fermions transform under E7, only the bosons transform under E7. So all of these components, LABCD, all non to L, alpha, beta, gamma, delta, all have to be separately E7 invariant. So now we've got a dimensional boost here. We have an object of less dimension, which still has to be E7. And remember what I told you about this piece, which is all we could talk about in the 1980s. It just made it to be invariant under the constant shifts of 70 scalars. Aha, we've got a way to grab it by looking at this piece. This is part of a covariantization that we weren't paying attention to before, and in fact, it fails. So that's another way of seeing that the art of the fourth counterterm doesn't work. These duality rules it out, as well as the supersymmetry discussion. So that's basically what I've said here. You start by looking at the constant shifts of the 70 scalars and require that all of these form components have to be separately duality invariant, and then you've got it. Okay? So the 0-4 component here is not invariant under constant shifts of the 70 scalars, and the art of the fourth invariant is ruled out. So yet another way to see that. This type of analysis allows you now to ping pong back to other questions that we can ask of our unitarity friends. You can look at lesser supergravities. You can look at n equals 5 and n equals 6. And the art of the fourth invariance in n equals 5 and n equals 6 are likewise ruled out by the requirements of their duality invariances. There's a for loop type d squared r to the fourth invariant in n equals 6 supergravity, and that's also ruled out. That is just a note about it. You might have thought that could happen in 10 dimensions, but it in fact vanishes on shell in that case in the maximal supergravity. But in n equals 6 and n equals 5, these are viable candidates, which we now rule out, and indeed we'd like to see the results of these calculations. Hopefully they agree. Okay, so the final topic is how we can use the unitarity results to show when infinities do occur to prove other situations where they don't occur. And this involves a rather nice interaction also with string theory, particularly the work of Pierre and Michael Green. So some of the most interesting cases are not covered by the discussion I've given so far here. In particular, what I showed in that first table, 5 and 6 dimensions and 4-dimensional maximal supergravity, corresponding to the 1/4 d to the fourth r to the fourth and 1/8 BPS d to the sixth r to the fourth type counterterms. We can't get the, well, maybe by further effort on the analysis I just gave you might, but it's not easy. But there's a different kind of duality-based argument that we can use. We know that precisely such counterterms do occur in some situations. Let's also include the art of the fourth yet again into the discussion. In one loop in 8 dimensions, it occurs as a counterterm, Bing, we know that. In 2 loops in 7 dimensions, the 1/4 BPS operator, d to the fourth r to the fourth, that occurs. And in 6 dimensions, the 1/8 BPS d to the 6 r to the 4th occurs. Moreover, when you reduce these general structures, which is r to the 4th, d to the 4th r to the 4th, or d to the 6th r to the 4th, down to 4 dimensions, we know from analysis of Drummond, Hessel, Powell, and Kirsten that in fact the 4-dimensional versions of these are unique. There's only one candidate sitting there that has to be somehow related to these by dimensional reduction. And so these are definite objects that occur in the higher dimensions, and they correspond to unique counterterms in 4 dimensions. Well, what do we learn from that? Well, remember that these higher dimensions have their own duality symmetries. Okay, and the counterterms occur because our unitarity friends showed them that by calculation that there's an infinity, so they must be okay. Whatever else we say about those kind of terms, they must be okay. In order for them to be okay, the purely gravitational parts here, one thing that you can easily study is the purely gravitational parts here cannot be covered by e to the phi scalar prefactors, because what happens under duality transformation is the scalar shift. And if there's an e to the phi prefactor in front of r to the fourth, it's dead. It won't be invariant under the corresponding symmetries, which are given here in H7 and 6 dimensions, SL3 cross SL2, SL5, and SL5.5. The lowest order shift symmetries would be violated. So these have to start as cleanly gravitational expressions without e to the phi's in front. Of course, this is a phenomenon that we're familiar with at the level of the action. We want the n equals 8 action to be clean as well in order to see the Kramer-Julliard symmetries. Now, of course, this depends upon reduction into what we call Einstein frame, such that the metric is invariant under the duality. And we arrange that by doing appropriate scalings under the dimensional reduction, precisely to make sure that we don't have phi squared type prefactors in front of this. So you can do that on the action. But having done that on the action, you've determined your style of dimensional reduction. And there's no guarantee that these other operators are going to play ball and have the same nice feature that they reduce to terms without e to the phi prefactor. So that's why, by knowing in the higher dimensions when there are infinities, we know where there are duality invariants in the higher dimension. And we reduce it to the lower dimension, they're likely to produce e to the phi prefactors, which would then rule them out. So there's the nub of the argument, that the lower dimensional versions of these can be ruled out precisely by the occurrence of them in the higher dimension. So in fact, this is also where we're going to make a connection to string theory by studying the invariant structures here. Now there's another complication here that one has to deal with, that when you, basically the feature is as you dimensionally reduce, you get more of these duality symmetries than you get just by guaranteed from dimensional reduction. You get a GLNR symmetry by the constitution from dimensional reduction. But then because of dualizations of vectors turning into scalars and so forth, you have an enlargement of the duality symmetries, and we want all of it, okay? So, and in fact, this happens also to the G over H divisor subgroup doesn't even come manifestly from dimensional reduction either. And even, in order to see the SU8, you have to dualize all the scalars to make a 70. So that's a representation of SU8. So what you get by direct dimensional reduction doesn't even display the SU8. But you can say, and this was basically the point observed by Elvang and Kiermaier, you can take what you get by dimensional reduction, translate all forms, two forms, into scalars, antisymmetric two tensors convert into scalars in four dimensions. Now you have the right number of scalars, but it's not written in an SU8 fashion. But then you make it symmetric by twirling it around. You just average it by integrating over the coset. So in the corresponding cosets here, just average it out, and that'll force it to be SU8 invariant. Hopefully it's a matter of just rewriting it, but these rewritings are rather complicated because they're nonlinear transformation, rechanges of fields that you have to make and so forth. So this is in fact an unpleasant integration to do in practice. The SU8 averaging is difficult to do explicitly. However, this is where string theory comes in and reminds you of a nice feature. This is very similar to the study that Michael Green and Pierre Van Hove did of the counterterms from a string theory point of view. The prefactors, we want to know what the structure of these e to the phi prefactors are. They satisfy some nice Laplace equations. Actually, in their case, there were Laplace equations with sources which became discretized for the string theory case, and we will not be discretizing them, but nonetheless, we can use the same idea. So, in fact, we derive a Laplace equation for the prefactors here. This counterterm, d to the 2n minus 3 r to the 4th counterterm, covering all cases together, has a scalar prefactor fn that has to satisfy this Laplace type equation. So this is on the scalar manifold, like E7 over SU8.
Okay, where do those numbers come from?
By starting with your known cases, knowing that there's a Laplace equation, figuring out what the Laplace equation has to be, right? Now, in fact, this equation is SU8 covariant, so in fact it doesn't care about this averaging that you have to do. I mean, in principle, in some cases, like to go to 8 dimensions, we were able to actually do the averaging to make sure that we're telling you the truth here. To go to the lower cases, it's your averaging over some, you know, and to average SU8 over these other cosets is rather nasty. But we can study what the coefficient function has to be. In order to have duality invariant, Fn has to be just 1. It has to have a solution which is just 1, but there's a source term here involving all sorts of dimensional stuff. So that's what I've said here, is the source term has to just be 1 for duality invariants to work, and there are discrete numbers of solutions there. Obviously, the starting cases have to be there. So we have known infinities at 1, 2, and 3 loops in 8, 7, and 6 dimensions. And that, in fact, was basically built into that equation. But then we see that we cannot have E7 invariants in 4 dimensions for any of these guys. The 1/2 BPS r to the 4th, now a third way of killing it. Also the 1/4 BPS d to the 4th r to the 4th. And the 1/8 BPS d to the 6 r to the 4th. So bottles of wine were lost on not understanding this earlier. And because the counterterm candidates in 4 dimensions are unique, just based upon supersymmetry in the SU8, their failure to be invariant rules out the corresponding infinities on a duality basis. You can also now turn around the argument and use the uniqueness to confirm that there are possibilities in higher dimensions where the same general Laplace equation needs to be satisfied. You can go back up. And you can see where the possibilities are. You relearn that the only dimensions in which the r to the 4th counterterm can occur are 11 dimensions, where there are no scalars anyway, because it's the birth dimension of maximal supergravity, and the 8-dimensional case where it occurred at one loop. Similarly, the d to the 4th r to the 4th can be duality invariant only in 7 dimensions, where the calculation was found, and the only dimension in which the 1/8 invariant can be duality invariant in 6 dimensions. So again, in principle, there are checks that can be made on the basis of that. So in fact, the one main output of this duality discussion is the for loop case in 5 dimensions, where we agreed in Rome that, in fact, we now understand why you found a cancellation here. The d to the 6th r to the 4th counterterm would otherwise have been expected, but it fails on the duality basis. So I guess it's about time to wrap this up. Here's the current outlook now. The next place that one can discuss is 7 loops, 4 dimensions. This is changing by the minute now because we have ongoing work with Pierre and Guillaume Bossard and Paul Howe. And when I wrote this yesterday, I thought that there could be an invariant at 7 loops, 4 dimensions, that's 16 power counting weight, which could be the volume of superspace. Now, we think that, I don't know, depending on signs and time of day, it looks now like this vanishes, but there is a candidate counterterm at this dimensionality. So that still is the current leading candidate. So now I've reproduced the table here. I guess green doesn't show very well. Anyway, the anticipated divergences here are, well, I said 0 BPS degree. That probably, who knows, should be changed. But we still think that 7 loops in 4 dimensions, 6 loops in 5 dimensions, of course, you guys don't like these integral dimensions because they force you to go to too high loops. But if you take the 4-particle calculation and accept that you can work in fractional dimensions, there will be a, this is the one that's 24 over 5 dimensions, I guess, is the one to look at. That's the 5-loop case, right, where is the next place to look at.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah. So, is it time for another bet?
I think it is. Make a bet.
Right.
So the bet is whether n equals 8 supergravity and n equals 4 superyang mills have the same degree of divergence or the same critical dimension those two theories have the same critical dimension. So on my side, yes. On his side, supergravity will be worse.
Yes.
For all loop-orders?
No, no, this is the specific case at five.
One order at a time.
So just a word about the wines here. Of course, this is a Santa Barbara wine. I think you can go down and taste it in the wine tasting place downtown. This wine, I picked it because it's one of the wines that's being promoted in this wedding that's happening on Friday over in London. It's an English wine.
Any questions? So can you show back the slides where you have the differential equation?
Yeah.
So
we don't have a source term.
If you parameterize this, if you change what you call n to relate it, so that it's the power of the divergence is related to the loop order where this quarter term occurs in perturbation. Okay. So the eigenvalue that they gives you that the eigenvalue vanishes exactly at the value when you have 4 plus 6 over L, where L is today. So the vanishing of
yes,
the
eigenvalue that, yeah.
for this operator that R to the 4th,
R to
the 6, R to the 4th, reproduces if you didn't know it from other argument, the critical formula 4 plus 6 over L. So up to that order, you can read off the critical dimension for the UV divergences, right? So this is a way that if you have access to this differential equation, so forget the source term. So
right. This is classical supergravity, so there's nothing on the right side.
Yes. So string theories want to have something not equal to zero for some reason I can explain, but so if you have a way to derive the differential equation, have access to the eigenvalues, whatever method you use, then you can read off the critical dimension for the UV divergences. Mm-hmm. And so this is the way we got it with Michael Green, but this is as well the people, I mean, using this either SU8 averaging or like Henriette and Michael Kermaier, or Kelly Steller and Guillaume Bossard and Paul O with their method, they always fall onto the same. So what you have to do is that you have a differential equation, the eigenvalue, you look where the eigenvalue is vanishing.
Yeah.
And when you increase the dimension of the operator, then you are certainly getting operators that are not eigenvalues that satisfy nice eigenvalue equation, but are some function that satisfy eigenvalue. So it's enough that one of the function has a zero eigenvalue. Mm-hmm. And then you can read off the critical dimension for the UV divergences associated with that operator. So it's really, really completely algebraic, but I mean, normally there's a one-to-one correspondence with extracting the degree of divergence by doing perturbation. So.
Right, yeah, I agree with you completely.
So that was the comment I wanted.
Any more? Okay, well, let's thank Kelly for inviting this talk.